Hello, this is Chris O'Regan, and you're listening to The Sausage Factory. It's episode 488 of The Sausage Factory. In this episode, I interview Casson Crooker of Speed of Dark Studios about the design and development of Rococo audio game Pantastique, an audio-only spatial puzzle game. I love puzzle games, but to have it as an audio-only one really intrigued me, and I encountered Rococo, and it's a really difficult name to say. I'm fairly certain I got it wrong a couple of times in this episode, so apologies to Casson for that. But anyway, be that as it may, just look it up on Steam. You do Rococo and you'll find it. It's a wonderful game, which I encountered at the Seattle Indie Games Expo just during PAX in 2023, PAX West, that is, in Seattle. And I do love that expo because I always discover weird and wonderful games there. And this did not disappoint. Really, really fun and also somewhat terrifying game sometimes, but it definitely is more on the puzzle side of things rather than the drama, so to speak. So we delve into the complexities of making an audio-only game, basically removing all other senses, and it's just focusing on your ears and what your ears can tell you about the space or the virtual space you're in. And it's a fascinating talk. It's a bit of a long one, I must confess, but considering the subject matter, it shouldn't be any surprise that this is a somewhat longer episode than normal. So, without further ado, let's listen to me talk to Casson about the creation of Rococo audio game Pantastique. Chris, take it away. Hello, Casson.
Greetings, Chris. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Could you tell us who you are and what you do?
Absolutely. I'd like to. Hi, all. My name is Casson. I am a video game developer. I'm currently based in Seattle, Washington, in the United States. I have been making games on and off for over 20 years now. I got into games back in the late 90s, developing games, where I'm an audio person, so my background is all audio. So I became an audio director at a company called Papyrus, which made NASCAR racing games. And at the time, they were making a game called Grand Prix Legends. So I actually got my start in the game industry as an audio person focused on games around race car driving, which was odd because I'm not really into race cars. My background is music and writing electronic music and so forth. But I wanted to break into that industry, and it was a really great introduction to the games industry. And then fortuitously, shortly after, I moved over to a company called Harmonix in Boston and had a very long run there for about 13 years, making a lot of music games, Guitar Hero, Rock Band, Rock Band Beatles, the Dance Central games, and even their first two early music games, Frequency and Amplitude. And so that was sort of my long run in the video game industry. And then I took a break for a while and switched careers into spatial audio And I worked at Microsoft on the early HoloLens. And through Spatial Audio, I got back into making indie games and VR projects. And so it's been sort of a circuitous journey through different kinds of audio technology and music video game experiences.
Thank you for answering the second question before I made it.
Well, I can go into even more depth.
It how often happens to guests when I ask them who they are and what they do. And then they go, yes. And I've been doing this for like, oh yeah. So how did you make your start making video games? But this, yeah, it sounds like you, the car engine noises were your thing for a little bit. And then we moved on to other greater things. And thank you for Amplitude and all these other titles that you, the music games, which were, I remember the height of it, the very height of it in the 2000s. What a time. All those instruments.
2008, I think, in particular, was a really great year. All those games, music games were hitting their stride, and that's when they sort of like really captured, I think, the zeitgeist. And you couldn't go to a party without a game like Guitar Hero or Rock Band.
And people still play them to this day, as you well know. People do as many, they have the permanent setup just in their basement somewhere, and they're like, okay, let's go and play Rock Band for 3 hours or so. And people do it because they just fantasize about being in a band. Like now they don't have to, because even though they don't have to play chords so much, but it's just, amazing. Although the drummer does need to know how to drum.
Of all the instruments, drumming is closest. And in fact, I mean, we can, if you want to talk about some of that stuff later on, I have some interesting stories about Guitar Hero and Rock Band turning non-musicians into actual musicians.
Indeed, which did happen, which is wonderful. It inspired many. So next question, as a creator, what are your biggest influences?
Let's see. Well, as a musician, probably my biggest influences are in the music domain, especially going back to seeing live concerts growing up as a kid, both in the classical domain and as well in the electronic domain. I grew up on 80s synth music like Depeche Mode and Erasure and Yazoo. And so that sort of formed a lot of my early interest in electronic music. And conversely, at the same time, I grew up playing a lot of 8-bit and early video games. I had an Intellivision. I didn't have an Atari. I had an Intellivision. And sort of grew up playing a lot of those very simple games. And so I think it's sort of that really instituted a love of simple game design ideas. And even to this day, my favorite games are really more in the domain of more casual games or casual indie games. I like the simplicity, especially if there's a game mechanic that is really unique. And so those are my early days back in the 80s. But now I draw inspiration from a lot of places. I based an entire interactive music VR project off of an art exhibit I saw about an art style I had never heard of before called Orphism. And I got really sucked into this art style that only lasted for about 3 years. And that spawned an entire VR idea. So you never know where inspiration is going to come from. I read a lot of science fiction books, and I based an entire album around Dante's Inferno. And so I think I get inspired maybe by an experience in one domain, like a book or music, and then that turns into a project in a different domain. And that's been a lot of source of inspiration for me over the years.
Yes. Literature has spawned many, many a video game. Yeah. So yes, good stuff. Next question. What video game developer do you admire most and why?
Wow, that's a tough question. There are quite a few. I would have to say I'm a huge fan of early Japanese music games. So games like Parappa Rappa, Mojibi Ribbon, which I believe were developed by Matsura and his team in Japan. You know, that really laid the groundwork for my love of music games. I had never played games before that, except for probably DDR. And so that was through Konami. And those were fun games because they got you up and moving. But I never felt really connected to the music. And maybe because it was just sort of a very utilitarian, the music was being just turned into these sort of abstract rhythmic concepts. And I would just, step my feet on the pad and I felt a little disconnected. But with games like Parappa, they had so much charm and story to them that I guess I just felt more connected to those games musically. And so from a creating music game point of view, those are probably my biggest inspirations. I'm also a huge fan of Play Dead, and so games like Limbo and Inside, and I'm really drawn to sort of dark story narrative games. So I really like those a lot. And the sound design in those games is really fantastic, and I love the music of those games. So a few different developers. Some of my other, probably one of my favorite games is Everything, where, you know, you can inhabit in this world anything you want. You can be a rock, you can be a house, you can be an entire galaxy. And I love that idea of moving between these sort of different entities and the impact on the world. And then, I really enjoyed Jonathan Blow's games. I'm a big fan of The Witness and Braid and those games. Some of them are too hard for me. I found The Witness to be particularly too difficult for me, but I enjoyed being in the world. And so, as you can see, I'm a big fan of indie game developers. That's sort of that's where I get drawn to. I think they tend to be a little bit smaller on scale. And as I mentioned, I don't play a lot of games that have where you get sucked into, 80 hours of gameplay. I love them from like an art point of view because they're just so immersive and beautiful, especially in VR. Like Half-Life Alyx, it's just a fantastic VR experience. But I get drawn towards shorter games where there's sort of a simple game design premise, and then the whole game is built around sort of tweaking those little game design ideas.
Indeed, the larger games I describe as, I'm in awe of the majesty of them. You know, the sheer amount of effort to create that is quite, but I'm also intimidated by it as well.
Yeah, so, right.
So this sort of like dichotomy going on. Exactly. You're awesome. I'm not touching you with a barge pole. Anyway, last question. Speaking of playing games, what are you playing right now?
You know, I am not playing any games right now. You caught me at a complicated point in life where I have a number of projects that are trying to get wrapped up. And so I have actually been very heads down in finishing the Rocococo game, which we're going to talk about a little bit more. And I'm also working on a music VR title. And so I've actually gotten sort of very heads down into those two worlds. Probably the most recent game I got to play, or at least inhabit the world for a little bit, was Thrasher, which is not released. And that's a VR game that is coming from the artist who worked on Thumper, the VR game and PC game Thumper, which I'm a massive fan of. And actually, I worked with him at Harmonix. He actually worked on Rock Band with me as well. He's working on a game called Thrasher, and they're starting to demo that. So I've actually been playing that game, which is unreleased. So sometimes being in the video games industry is sometimes fun because you get to play some games that haven't been officially released yet.
Well, that's great. That's even better than I think sometimes what you're currently playing. But yeah, I love Thumper, one of my favorite VR games. And indeed, I think it was an early PS4 game. I can't quite remember, but it was one of those ones that kind of cross over between two platforms, from two like flat screen, and then it went to VR, and it was just it's just.
I mean, the VR one, it really was the first, maybe the first real moment where I played a VR game where I just saw the power and immersiveness of VR. I just, that being in that world, and you don't really look around in that world, right? You're really focused on what's in front of you, but it just, I don't know, the immersiveness of that game is fantastic.
Indeed. And when you're reaching the end of a level, when it starts to spiral off and you can just relax just that bit, which is really important in games.
Again, talk
about
game.
It in Rocococo, that definitely happens there too. Like, can we just chill? Okay, just breathe. And that's that with Thumper, it's just like, oh, God, this is getting really intense. Because the music, just goes right through you. That kind of tune, you know, just doesn't mess around. Like, I'm just going through you, if you like it or not. The only way to stop it is to turn this off, all right? I'm not about to. But anyway, fantastic response to those questions. Thank you very much for the first half.
Absolutely.
There it is at the end. Let's move on to the second half of the show, where we're going to be delving deep into Rocococo.
Let's do it. We'll be right back.
So, can you tell us what it is? What is this extraordinary audio game? It is fantastic.
It is. I hope it's fantastic. The feedback I'm getting so far is that it is generally fantastic. Yes, this is an audio game, aka no visuals at all. And the game can be played equally by blind, sighted, and visually impaired players, which was my main idea in making a game. I wanted a unique design challenge to create a music game that really maybe had not been done before, not done maybe quite in this exact way. And after, you know, as mentioned, working at Harmonix for many years, I made quite a few rhythm action games. And those music games really, you know, are about tapping along to the beat of the music while being fed visual cues. And even back at the end of my run at Harmonix, there was a Kickstarter for a version of Rock Band that for blind and visually impaired players called Rock Vibe. And I was really intrigued by the device that they were creating to basically make that game more accessible. And so I think seeing that project come to fruition, I sort of squirreled away that idea in my head that maybe someday it would be fun to work on a project where it was a music game, but there were no visuals at all. And so I had some time starting about a year and a half ago to work on a game project. And so I sort of came back to the idea of like, how can I make a music game that isn't a rhythm action game? Like, what else can you do gaming wise around music? And that's where I really, you know, settled on the idea of wouldn't it be fun to try to create a game where you are basically hunting around through various kinds of puzzles to try to reassemble the tracks of music? So instead of using rhythm action to tap along on the bass part and the drum part to reassemble the song, this was more about spatially locating tracks of music in a space as quickly and as accurately as possible. So that was sort of the starting point. And I built a little prototype in Unity that sort of proved out that I could close my eyes and I could listen to some tracks of audio in a space and I could run around that space and try to find them. And it was fun and quite challenging, but I was a little worried that I, having never made a game like this, I really wanted to make sure that I was doing it correctly. And so I started to seek out some resources for audio games and ended up on a community called audiogames.net, where there is a very vibrant community of blind and visually impaired gamers, as well as game developers for audio games. And it's sort of an old school forum, sort of BBS style. And so I joined that and started asking questions. You know, what are the other games out there? I'd already played Papa Sangre, which is a game, spatial audio game from about, I don't know, 10 years ago. And I had played Blind Legend. So those were really the only two audio games I had played. But I got, you know, they gave me a wealth of resources for other games to play. And basically, I then very quickly made a prototype that I could give to that community. So I made a little 2 or 3 song prototype and with a tutorial and some voiceover to help you play the tutorial. And that was where I really got my first feedback of what was working well and what wasn't working well. The game had to be able to be played solely on a keyboard, but I also wanted to extend it so you could use a mouse. But of course, with a mouse, you can't see the mouse pointer. And so what do you use the mouse for? It's just like another control input. And so that community basically played that tutorial and those 3 levels and got me a lot of feedback about the paths that I was on that were working well and they were responding to and the areas that could be tightened up or avoided altogether. And so that was sort of the beginning of it. And because the feedback from that prototype was so positive and that community just is desperate for new games, right? They're constantly waiting for accessibility mods to be added to existing AAA games. And more companies now are starting to embrace that and add mods for different kinds of controller inputs, for like motor skills or screen readers for visually impaired folks, or, you know, or closed captioning for games. And so more and more having it, but there are very few games that are audio game only. And so I just got really enamored by making a game that I knew could it be accessible by anybody in that community. And then it was just the challenge of how can I create interesting music puzzles where there are no visuals.
And you've certainly done that with Rogue Cococo. It's just really been an ear opener. Sorry for that. Yeah. You probably heard that 1,000 times, but rare is the game where I play better when I close my eyes.
Exactly. Yes.
Because I've had to do that. because I just like too many distractions, too many stimulations. It could be anything. Like, yeah. No, I really need to just close my eyes at this point. And it helps. It sounds very strange, but it helps.
It really shows the difference between how our eyes can take in data and our ears can take in data, and awareness and spatial awareness and the context of the game, right? Our eyes can, our visual system can take in so much information so quickly. And we're also very good at having our brain just focus on what is necessary. Even though there's a lot of visual stimulation, we can really identify what's happening in the periphery and what's happening in our focus and react to that. With our ears, it's a completely different story. Hitting cognitive overload with our auditory system happens very quickly. And I found this a lot in working in spatial audio, where in that technology, where you're trying to, simulate sounds that are all around you. And, and in doing tests, even when I worked at Microsoft on their spatial audio system for HoloLens, the moment you go more than three sounds where you're asking the listener to be able to identify and spatially locate those three sounds, any above that, your brain starts to sort of freeze up and it all gets mushed together and you can't tease it apart. And so the cognitive overload with hearing happens much quicker. And so, as you said, I have found also that it's better for sighted people to close their eyes because it really gets your brain focused on the ears and parsing what you're hearing and reacting.
Yeah. Well, I think we sort of established some aspects of Rocococo to a point, but the premise of the game is that you are a detective that's been brought into in the near future.
Yep. A sonic detective.
Sonic detective. And you've been brought into this mansion, very large mansion, owned by a noble person, should we say. And yep. She has issues. She's not well.
She's not well.
She's not doing great. It's got to be said. She has anger management. There's things beyond that. Let's face it. Okay, I think we're being kind. And there's a robot helper you're greeted at the door, who I like very much. Yep. I think he's nice. Good. I don't think you could have pushed it over to the edge where he's Python-esque, but he's not. He's not. He's not that, he's much more, he's a kind fellow. I want to help him. Genuinely want to help him.
Yeah, the gentleman that did the voiceover for the robot butler is named Pete Beaumont, and he's in the UK.
Yeah.
And he and I worked quite a bit on trying to nail what his vibe was, right? It was basically the classic British butler. But I didn't want it to be too campy or over the top, as you mentioned, sort of Python-esque. But I also wanted him to have a little bit of a dry sense of humor. So he's sort of in on the joke with you to a certain extent. But yeah, I think Pete really nailed the vibe of the butler as your helper through the game.
Indeed. You could go from Python-esque sort of like silliness to caustic, rather vicious, which is Blackadder. And it's like this sort of scale. And you've got him where he's long suffering. He's putting up with it, and it's just that kind of like long suffering. Sort of really, I just want to cry, but I can't because I'm British. Trust me, I relate to this. Can't show emotion. What are you thinking?
Yeah,
super. Yeah, can't. It's stiff upper lip. It's not a fiction. It's real. It's real. But no, it's a wonderful thing. But you are then told that you need to find these music pieces for his own collection, his own restoration, for his own sanity, so to speak, for this. And but there are other beings and other creatures and other robots around that aren't so helpful. Indeed, they have the moniker of Harmbots.
That's right, Harmbots.
And some of them are stationary, at least initially. I don't want to spoil too much content here because The Sausage Factory is not about content spoiling. That's for Kane and Rince. We're here to talk about, the how, not too much the what.
Yep.
But they do things and you don't want to interact with them because if you do, you get hurt and the level ends and you've got to start again.
They also summon the queen also.
Oh, yeah.
And in many levels, you really don't want the queen to show up. In all levels, you don't want the queen to show up. And
she's not a hugging person, really.
It's best to stay away from the Harmbots.
Indeed. And there's bits where you, because you're just stumbling around in the dark, actual dark, because you cannot see, because you are indeed a sonic detective. I love the fact when you start hitting things, and things like you hit bottles, and it starts very early. Oh, yeah. And it starts very early in the game, but it's just like, doesn't matter initially. Boy, does it matter later on.
It doesn't matter later on, yeah. Well, now we're talking part of the game design, right?
Yeah,
which we
can
talk about more, is how to introduce things slowly and carefully, but that are sort of benign in earlier levels, but take on greater meaning or peril in later levels.
Speaking of design, I'll ask you, this is sort of like a run-up question, but the experience is, shall we say, flat. Not in a negative way, but I don't remember playing through and working my way through, much happening outside the plane of left and right. And I don't remember anything going above or indeed below.
And
it's quite interesting because in most video games, recent, maybe last 20 years, we've been trained to look up and down, which we don't normally do in real life, which is odd, but that's another discussion for another time. But I just found, and it really feels like, and we were sort of talking in the virtual green room, everyone off air, about how it feels like a puzzle game in a grid, and your only interaction with the elements and the things inside is sound, but also position, your position relative to the thing. Right. Sometimes it's bad, sometimes it's something you do not desire, i.e. proximity to the palm bots. And there's been wonderful points where I've found myself navigating, squeezing my way through a pair of harm bots just to get the sound. Right, I love when I really feel the endorphins go through when I'm actually just planning that out. Going, I know it's right there.
A little bit of room.
And and when you're in that place, when you can see with your ears, That's a magical point with Coco. It's just wonderfully done. But I just have to ask, why did you limit it to a flat plane? Was there any ideas about why did you not go up and why did you not look at the Z coordinates, so to speak?
So there are a couple of answers for that. One of them is more of a meta answer, which is less about trying to have design issues and more about the scope of the game. And so a lot of people ask me, well, what about this? And did you try this? And I was like, oh, I tried that, but I didn't want to do it. And inevitably it just comes down to, I actually couldn't make a very large game. I didn't want to spend a lot of time. I don't like working on games that take many years. In fact, I was hoping this game would only take 1 year, and it actually took a year and a half. But a lot of that had to do with getting onto Steam, which has its own problems, and making a Mac version, which has its own problems, et cetera, et cetera. But I wanted the scope of the game to actually be pretty well controlled and well scoped without a lot of feature creep. And so many of the ideas, including up or down, got discarded because I was worried from a feature creep point of view that it was going to add so much complexity to the game that the scope of the game would become a little untenable for a very small team. And when I say small, it was essentially me and one Unity programmer who was also going to school at the same time. And we sort of chipped away at this as a passion project. And so a lot of design ideas didn't make it in just because I didn't have the time or scope or budget to add them. From a design point of view, though, there are a few different things that led to some decisions. The up-down decision was largely due to the constraints of spatial audio. So in the game, spatial audio is the technology that's simulating you being able to hear sounds realistically in a simulated world around you so that you know if something is in front of you or behind you or to the left or the right, since you can't see it. Up and down in spatial audio doesn't work super well. It works okay with some kinds of technology, but there's a lot of humans that have problems with anything that goes off of the azimuth, which is on the horizontal plane that your ears hear on. And so if you put a sound directly above you, it can sometimes sound like it's below you. It can sometimes sound like it's in front of you. It can actually become sort of spatially confusing. And so I was worried about a situation where a player needed to look up, but they wouldn't know to look up. And so it just seemed like a very complicated audio problem. If I ever do a sequel, which I would love to do, a follow-up for this game, that's probably something I would, that's probably one of the things I would add, is the ability, two abilities. If I ever did a sequel, I would deal with being able to move up or down. And in fact, from a design point of view, I'm quite interested in bringing this game over to VR. Because spatial audio in VR works really well because with the device on your head, you have head tracking. And so that information makes spatial audio sound really good. And in VR, you have sort of less constraints. You can sort of look in any direction and then go in that direction. So I'd love to embrace that again in the future if I could. And then the other design, big design decision that's sort of related to up and down were walls. And one of the things you may notice in the game is that for most of the levels, there are no walls, even though you're supposed to be in a room in a palace. So I'm in like the chapel of the palace or the game room or the parlor. And in those rooms, there are actually no walls. And in the original design of the game, I had walls. And it's a really interesting design conundrum because you would run into the wall because you can't see the wall. And then I would have to give you an audio cue that you ran into the wall. And in some levels in the game that shipped, I do have maybe three or four levels that do have walls. And so there's a sound effect that plays and the butler's like, you run into the wall. The problem is that because you can't see the wall, you don't know what angle you hit the wall at. Did you run into the wall directly 90 degrees, right, perpendicular? Or did you hit the wall at an angle? And if you hit the wall at an angle, and then I tell you, you've run into a wall, but I don't tell you what angle you've run into the wall, you don't know how far to turn to not run into the wall, especially if you have gotten yourself into a corner, and then there are two walls. And so in the prototype with walls, you were constantly hitting a wall, constantly hearing the butler being like, you've hit a wall, and then you just keep hitting the wall over and over. And so we made a design choice. Let's just remove all the walls and tile the room infinitely in all directions. So you can just keep running straight and the room and all of the obstacles, the harm bots and the audio zones basically tile out infinitely in front of you. And it was actually a pretty clever and elegant way to solve a problem. And what's funny is nobody's really complained. I've never heard somebody be like, how come there are no walls? It's just, you sort of just take it for granted. You're in this like infinite room. And so walls up and down, some of those were basically conscious design choices that were very challenging to do when there are no visuals.
Yeah. Very Mario Galaxy like. Just roll around a big cylinder. It's fine.
Yep, exactly.
Now I'm going to talk about player satisfaction, the reward you get from actually succeeding. I just want to know, in Rogue Cococo, how have you encouraged player performance? What do you do to make it, you know, once they've grokked it, terrible phrase, I've just used it, apologies to everyone, but once they've got their ear-walking things going on, what do you do to encourage them to, like, you know, you got this, but, you know, you could do even better. Hey, because that's the thing about puzzle games and tactical games like this is the reward of sense of perseverance and then excellence. What do you think you're doing here? I hope I know the answer to this, but I want you to expand to the Sausage Factory audience. What have you done?
Sure, yeah. Mainly in the game, it's all about accuracy. Initially in the early prototypes, the game was about speed and accuracy. But I ultimately made the decision to decouple the two and focus on accuracy. Given that an audio game is probably the first time for many gamers they're encountering this kind of game, I was conscious about not asking too much of the player in the game. And so really it's about like, just try to get this thing as accurately as possible. And so start to trust your listening skills and your navigating around the space skills. And then you get rewarded based on that. And there is no score in the game. It's really, you are awarded cake. So Marie Antoinette said, let them eat cake. And so in the game, when you do well, you get 5 pieces of cake. And when you do poorly or acceptably, you only get 1 piece of cake. But in later levels, there is a time element to it. So rather than being scored on time, I do put a time constraint, which is that you need to finish this level. In many cases, you need to finish the level before the song ends. So rather than just having it be sort of an arbitrary, you know, you've got like 2 minutes to complete this level. I do have one level that's like that. But in most of the timed levels, it's you need to complete this level before the song ends. And so there you're listening to the song and realizing, oh, I'm actually, you know, after you've played a couple of times, you're like, oh, I know the end of the song is coming up. I actually hurry up and complete the level before the song ends. So there is a timing aspect. And then for sighted players on the screen, there is a metric that is showing you your accuracy and a counter that's showing you your score. So I think some people out there who are really enamored by speed runs might start to go back and say, oh, well, I got 5 pieces of cake on this level. I can't do any better from an accuracy point of view, but I can certainly do better from a speed point of view. And how quickly can I now go back to an earlier level that was actually quite easy and you could beat in, say, 40 seconds or 50 seconds. But can I, you know, is there a challenge now that I can beat it in 30 seconds? And so one of the things I'm hoping to do, especially over with the Steam community and with the audiogames.net community, is start to have speedrun challenges and try to have little contests to say, you know, who can finish level 5 with 5 pieces of cake and a highest accuracy possible, but also with the fastest amount of time? Or who can complete levels where they made it through the game without ever getting killed by the queen or killed by a harm bot? So there are Steam achievements that can reward you for excellence in certain domains in the game. Beyond that, there's not a lot of replayability hooks. And I will say that that's probably one of the areas of the game I would like to expand on over time. It's a very simple game. There are 13 levels. It's not a very expensive game. Players can probably beat the game in an hour or hour and a half. Or if you really want to like get 5 pieces of cake and earn all the Steam achievements, it could take several hours. But there's not a huge amount of replayability in the game. You know, I think some players will be brought back in to try to do, to, you know, get all the achievements or get faster scores. But I'm thinking now that the game is released, how I can either add this in a sequel to the game, or if I have time and interest from players to add more levels to the game and have those levels have puzzles that are more based on replayability.
You mentioned the harm bots. We've already mentioned them already in this show, and I want to expand on them a little bit more, because to me they're like Rococo's answer to bullet hell. Okay. And that you're dodging and weaving your way through them to get to those music strands, those not so much melodies, that sort of, that can be anything. It could be a bass line, could be all sorts of parts of a music. And we mentioned earlier how it's weaving in, but I just want to ask, how have you managed to, what have you done to design it in such a way that it is possible to get through them? What is the narrowest margin? What kind of things have you been doing? Because there's many times where I've found myself getting flustered and go, I tell you what, I'm just going to walk around them, then come back on myself, pick up and then move on, because they can be clustered sometimes. But really, yeah. The ultimate question really is, the point of the question is, how have you found the distance? The distance between the enemies, the smallest sort of like eye of a needle kind of thing, how mm-hmm. close have you managed to get them before it becomes untenable? Because they are emitting sounds every time, you know they're there, but you're also trying to hear through them to the music that you're trying to get hold of. But I just want to ask, how have you managed to design that spatial limit? Because they are funneling the player.
Exactly. That was probably the bulk of the amount of tuning that the game required, both in the initial design and then the difficulty tuning of the levels, is how many audio zones. So those are the tracks of audio. So in early levels, there may be only 6 tracks of audio you need to capture. And in later levels, there may be over 15 different audio zones to capture. And then interspersed in that level, which changes sizes. In early levels, the rooms are tiling generally smaller, and in larger levels, the rooms are actually getting much larger. And so, as you mentioned, it really was an exercise in sort of spatial layout. Where are the audio zones in space? How close are they to each other? And then what are the harm bots doing in that space? Are they static? In early levels, they tend to be static and not moving around. And again, this is about introducing the player through a difficulty curve to be able to get to build their skills and get better. So in early levels, you know, you encounter harmbots for the first time, they're not moving. In the final levels, they're moving around. And they actually get quite close to each other, which are the moments I think you mentioned where you can suddenly hear 2 harmbots on either side of you and they're moving, and they might be moving in different directions and different speeds. and what do you do during those moments? And so there was a lot of intentionality about how close they get to each other, which also relates to what they're doing from in the audio domain. So the tracks of audio, which you're trying to capture, are playing at a certain fixed loudness, and they have a volume curve so that when you are, say, 6 meters away from them is when you might start to hear it, one coming up either in front of you or to the left or right of you. But the harmbots are tuned a little bit differently. You can only hear harmbots when you're only about 4 meters away. And so I wanted to do that so that you could hear more of the audio around you, and that harmbots sort of snuck up on you a little bit more unexpectedly. And so you have to react. So if you're running through the game full speed, it's actually tuned so that if you're running right at a harmbot, the moment you start to hear the harmbot, you do have time to change the direction you're running just enough. So a lot of that relationship between how fast you're running and how quickly you can hear something and how soon it will do damage to you is basically the crux of the game design itself, is was tuning those things. And then additionally, I then change those sizes as the game progresses. So in early levels, you hear harmbots sooner than you might in later levels. You also hear audio zones much farther away in lower levels. And the accuracy zone to capture the audio zone is also increased in earlier levels and shrinks in later levels. And again, it's all in the spirit that my expectation is that in earlier levels, players are getting used to this novel game mechanic. And so I need to give them some leeway to be able to do well and not get hurt. But later on in the game, my expectation and assumption and hope is that they've honed those skills and now they can run faster. They can capture audio zones with a much smaller window of space around them. So your accuracy gets better and your reaction time to avoiding harmbots goes up. So yeah, what you touch on is really the main aspect of the whole design of the game is the spatial relationship of harmbots and audio zones to the player related to the speed that they're moving, and then delivering the audio experience to make it feel like you actually can, you know, you can tell those distances and your speed without getting any visual cue.
Yeah, and what's really fascinating is, one, you're trying to avoid because you want it out of your earshot. You want to push it away as far as...
Right.
Whilst the other one, you want to bring it centered. And it can be a bit like, you know, really confusing, you know, rubbing, you know, tapping the top of your head and rubbing your stomach. It's like, oh, 1 minute I'm trying to get towards the sound, another one I'm trying to avoid, and it's... It's
well,
easy.
And then I turn that, and for the entire game, it's a lot of that.
Yeah.
Except I made one level where you actually have to get, you have to find the harmbots.
That's true.
The queen basically she's really bored. She's turned everybody in the Palace of Versailles, all the humans, she's turned them all into robots because she just likes playing these games. As we mentioned, she's a little bit off her rocker.
Yeah,
so to speak. And so every level is a different game where she often changes the rules on you. And so you might have learned in earlier levels, oh, okay, I have to stay away from the harmbots. And then suddenly the queen's like, well, in this game, you actually have to find the harmbots and get right next to them because I attached all the audio zones directly to them. And now to find the audio zones, you have to find the harmbots.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so then you're like, wait a minute, I'm supposed to stay away from that. Now, in that level, the harmbots don't hurt you, but they summon the queen. So, and in that level, you can actually get most of the audio zones without actually triggering the queen to come and find you. But
yeah,
it's a very hard challenge in that level.
It is. It did make me chuckle. But yeah, it was a case of also like, really? Really? I've been trained to do this thing. I've been training my brain to do this thing and I have to reverse it. But that's a really classic kind of game system. Like, that's what you want to flip, yeah, flip the script. You think you got this? You think you're smart? You think you've broken the game? You think you're the king of the world? Not today.
Yeah. Yep. Something new you have to do.
Yeah. Here's the rug. Now pulling it under. There you go.
Yeah. And again, going back to my original point about trying to make a game that did not have a lot of scope, I did actually have to introduce a new mechanic into the game that I was not originally doing, which is the cloaking mechanic. And again, I don't want to give too much away from the game, But about halfway through the game, the player gets a new, they get a new ability. And my original plan was to not do that. I really like games that are built on one premise, and then you can build all these puzzles on that one premise. But as I started designing the game, I realized that wasn't going to work. I sort of exasperated all the possibilities of an infinite room and hunting for audio zones and staying away from harm bots. And I was like, yeah, I could probably build about six levels out of this one idea. But I'm like, I don't think I can do, you know, 10 or 15 levels with this one simple idea. And so I really needed another game mechanic that would add combinatorial complexity to the game, that I could use that mechanic to do different things. So the cloaking mechanic was introduced to basically turn everything on its ear. And I love games where mechanics can be used for multiple purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And so the cloak mechanic is actually introduced for one purpose, which is hiding from the queen, because at some point the queen starts to have the ability to run faster than the player. And so you can use cloak to hide from her, but then you can use cloak for a different thing, which I won't talk about. You'll have to go experience it. But I love game mechanics that have multiple uses mm-hmm. from a single game mechanic idea. And so that was introduced halfway through the game. You get a new skill.
Yeah, you do indeed. And it's hinted at in the help screen. It's sort of like, there's a button for cloak. I'm like, what? Yep. Well, it's not doing anything. Well, it won't yet. You haven't got it yet. Anyway.
that's the other problem is that a lot of those help screens don't have contextual awareness of where you are in the game.
No.
They're just help screens.
They're just help screens.
I guess people will get a clue early in the game that maybe something is going to come later in the game.
Yeah. The last question. It's on the subject of sound crafting, for want of a better word. What did you do? What filters do you apply? Oh, that's a terrible term, but a very layman thing to say. But what things did you do? What scientific things did you do to the sounds to make sure that they are distinct from what they are useful, that they are, you know, because they do get a sense that there's a little bit of conceit here, a little bit distortion, a little bit, maybe I'm wrong, but I just got the feeling that there were some things you were doing to make it just that little bit more clearer. Could you go through that with us? If indeed you did anything, maybe I'm imagining it, but it just felt
As an audio game, there was a lot of work done in the audio domain. And as I mentioned earlier, right, the whole cognitive overload, when you get too many sounds happening, your brain can't really tease them apart. What am I hearing? Am I hearing a harm bot? Am I hearing an audio zone? Is that the queen? What's going on? And so, yes, a lot of work was done in the audio design. So I already touched on the volume curves, right? How far away do you hear sounds when you're next to a sound? So I already sort of touched on using volume and distance as a way to understand, is the harm bot right next to me? Is it far away? You know, how close is the threat, or how close is the audio zone I need to capture? So volume tuning alone was a pretty complicated and lengthy tuning process. But some of the other things I did were really, so in the game, because it's using spatial audio technology and it's based around music, I'm at the subject of what each song has in its own song. Some songs have really bright synthesizer sounds. Some of them have sort of dull pad sounds. But those are the sounds that you have to capture for better or worse. And so in some levels, it's very easy to find the audio zones. It's like a very crisp hi-hat, right? And you can sort of pick it out immediately. And then in other game levels, there are some sounds, musical elements, that are quite hard to find. And that's challenging. And some of the levels are, you end up missing one of the audio zones because it's a bass sound that has a lot of low frequencies, and those don't go through spatial audio technology very well. And so that's very challenging. And it's why I added a game mechanic, a function called zone boost. So you have the ability, if you get stuck and you don't know where the audio is around you, just that, not the harm bots or the queen, just the audio, the music tracks, you can engage zone boost, which basically takes all those volume curves and turns them way up. It's like super hearing. And so that will help. Of course, the problem is that leaving it on, you can't hear harm bots. So if you sort of leave it on and start running around the room, you inevitably run into a harm bot and die because you couldn't hear it around you. So zone boost was another sort of audio technique to help the player navigate situations. But the last piece that was very challenging was making sure that the Harmbot sounds were very different than the music. So the Harmbots are talking to you. They got these robot voices and they're like sort of repeating a line. And actually every single Harmbot in every level says a different line. So there are hundreds and hundreds of Harmbot lines and they're specific to the level. So like if you're in the kitchen, the Harmbots are talking about making food. And of course, you can't really tell what they're saying because if you get too close to them, you die. But I added a warning sound to them. So if you get really close to a Harmbot, you start to hear them talking and that's your cue to like sort of move away. But if you get way too close, like dangerously close, they actually emit an alert, sort of an alarm looping sound. And that lets you know that if you don't change course within, let's say, 1 second, you're probably going to get harmed by them. And it took a long time to create that loop to separate itself from the music itself. So you could clearly hear the difference between the Harmbot, you know, danger loop versus a synthesizer sound. So yeah, a lot of work was done to try to create sounds in different classes that sounded different from each other so that the player sort of knew what they were listening to. Am I hearing something that's friendly? It's like friend or foe. So yeah, a lot of audio design went into that domain.
Yeah, I equated it to visual games in that the world they present, especially in first person, is actually distorted. The world doesn't actually look like this. You know, the right. Wide angles and the, you know, you've seen it all the time. We just accept it because that's how it is. But when it comes to a flat, less VR, because VR, you can actually get away to do more traditional, well, as the world actually is. Whereas in, you know, so that's what I felt like you what you were doing here. And the booster, that for me, as a phrase I use when I'm using things like that in games called feathering, in that I'm basically using it optimally, but not at the expense of other things, which means I have to turn it on and off. So it's not rapid, which is normally what feathering is, but it's sort of, you hit it, okay, that's over there, then I let go. Because otherwise, you're right, running with it on is a very stupid thing to do. On the early part of the levels, early levels is a great idea, but even then, it's not advisable because you really need to be getting your ear legs quicker than you
exactly. Right. If you rely too much on that as a crutch, it will hurt you in later levels because you have avoided learning the skills you need to complete later levels, which is why I made sure that it actually, if you use it too much, it has the potential to harm you. That was the way I, you know, tried to justify to the player, you know, don't leave this thing on, right? There's a negative to leaving it on. Use it just enough in targeted moments to help you, but don't leave it on.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Rocococo, Audio Game Fastest Geek.
It is out now.
It is out now. It's been developed by the wonderfully named Speed of Dark Games.
Thank you.
I mean, that's just, I don't even ask where that name comes from. It's genius. You know, everyone bangs on about Speed of Light. It gets all the thing, doesn't it? It gets all the praise. Like, even like distance is measured on that. No one talks Speed of Dark. No. No,
I'm
they don't.
Kind of dark matter, the mysterious dark matter.
Dark matter, yeah. What about the Speed of Dark? And what platforms is it available on?
So it's available for Mac and PC on Steam, and that's where there are Steam achievements. But I'm also offering it through my Bandcamp page, which is sort of an unpredictable place to buy video games. But given that I'm a musician and composer, I have many albums on my Bandcamp page, and so you can get a standalone version for Mac or PC when you buy the soundtrack. So on Bandcamp, if you buy the soundtrack, it's the same price as on Steam, but you get the soundtrack and then you get download instructions to get the Mac or PC standalone version, which you just download and play right on your local computer. Of course, there are no Steam achievements because it's outside of the Steam ecosystem. But I have found, especially for some blind and visually impaired players, the Mac implementation of Steam is not great with their screen readers, and there's some challenges. And so I got enough requests for standalone Mac version in particular that it led me to wanting to offer the game through a different, a different path than just Steam.
That's fine. Casson, it's been wonderful having you on the show. Genuinely has. You've been very open and honest about the creation of Rococo. Audio Game Fantastique. It's been, very illuminating. Or irrimating, whatever, audio mating, whatever that means. But it's been great. And I do wish you the very best of luck in your future endeavors. But thank you.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's been a pleasure chatting on the Sausage Factory, and congrats on your many years. And 11, what did you mention? 11 years now? So that's fantastic. And always love talking about game design and sort of what drives inspiration for making games. So appreciate the opportunity to chat with you about it.
What a great guest. Thank you, Casson, for being so open and honest about the creation of an extraordinary game that is Rocococo. Next week, episode 489, features River Tales, Stronger Together, a co-op puzzle game created by Kid Onion Studio. I talked to Francesco Mazza and Gabriel Ganimi of Kid Onion Studios about its creation. Until then, bye!
You have been listening to the Sausage Factory podcast, part of the Kane and Rince Collective. Support us for just $2 per month at patreon.com/Kane and Rince for early, extended, and exclusive podcasts. Find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Twitch, YouTube, and at our website, kaneandrince.com.